It's April, so that means it's time to kick off our annual Poetry Month series, Muses and Metaphor. All month long, we are inviting you to tweet your original poems in 140 characters or less using the hashtag TMM Poetry. This year, though, we have added a twist. We have invited some of the regular contributors that you hear in the barbershop, the beauty shop, and our political chats and other segments to step outside of their comfort zones and try their hands at poetry. Joining us now to get us started is Connie Schultz. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author of And His Lovely Wife, a memoir from the woman beside the man. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Also joining us, Fernando Espuelas. He is host and managing editor of The Fernando Espuelas Show on Univision. Fernando, welcome to you.
Thank you
for
Michelle.
Joining us. I am so excited that both of you agreed to step outside of your normal comfort zones to do this and take a chance on this. So bravo you. You're actually braver than I. I have never been persuaded to do this. I probably shouldn't have told you this.
But I'm
telling you this after you've already written your poems.
Well, I'm glad my fear inspires you.
Exactly. Michelle. Thank you so much. So you are in town from Cleveland, and
yes.
Your poem was actually inspired by your flight. So let's hear it.
As you said, I come from Cleveland, where Superman was born. You knew that, right? He was he's not from Krypton. He's from, okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Tardy planes, zero leg room, connections late at night. Superman, I hate to ask, but I sure could use the flight.
I love it.
And I would look very cool riding on his back.
You totally would.
Figured out.
Totally would.
That's wonderful.
Okay, Fernando, what about you?
Okay. Well, I was in Uruguay last week, and this is inspired by that. Toes at the edge of the widest river. I imagine arrival of long-ago sailors, the slaughtered charrua, inevitable. Now all are dust, cold toes.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you. So was it hard?
It was the hardest thing I've written in 25 years or so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Loved it.
That's great. Well, what made you do it?
Well, it was the challenge, and I also thought I write basically one thing about politics, and so the idea of just going into a totally different genre, of which I'm totally not qualified for, seemed like a challenge, and it took me a lot longer than it takes me to write a column. So, I'm still unhappy with it, but I
love
that's
it.
The nature.
Well, thank you for that. Well, in addition to writing your own poems, the other challenge that you've agreed to undertake is to look at the poems coming in on Twitter. So you've already picked some that have stood out for you, and you're going to share those, Connie. Why don't you start?
Okay. Platypus Tales at Flirty Bloomers wrote, "Her bones quite brittle. She slides down the banisters one last time." Mm-hmm. I love that. Mm-hmm. Martha Reynolds at The Other Martha 1, "I am my mother's daughter, but she does not know my name. She called me Faye, and I said, Faye's dead. That made her laugh, so... good." And this is from Aaron. I'm going to apologize if I get the name wrong. Aaron Toleos, at Toleos. "Morning commute. I can't go fast enough towards it. This fat blue sky. This flood above my knuckles and the wheel."
Oh, nice.
Nice. What were some of the things that made the poem stand out for you?
I think in each case, I could imagine that moment, and not to make it all about me, but apparently I made it all about me.
That's good poetry,
I could admit, but that's the thing. It spoke to me. It didn't feel so obscure. And, you know, I'm the first to admit that when I love a poem and I love poetry, there's something in it that makes me think a little bit harder about my own world. And so each of these and that whole driving towards it, I just could, it was perfect.
Fernando, what about you?
Okay, I picked two poems, and I'm going to be challenged by the names, but I will try it. The first one's by Namitha Varma Rajesh. She's at Namit Havar, and she wrote, "We worship the mundane, we love the mediocre, we're in awe of the ordinary, we are stagnating without knowing it." Hmm. The second one is by Eusebia Phylos, which is at Eusebia _ Phylos. "Lepus chases Orion in pre-dawn sky over the horizon. I follow in my car on the way to work."
I love those both. They're different. They're both different. What is it that stood out for you?
Well, Namitha's poem about worshiping the mundane, I thought, speaks to a bigger truth in our society, very focused, I think, on trivia and not really focused on the bigger issues. And I do feel that in every society, even the most successful society throughout history at any period of time, eventually, if it's not careful, will stagnate and fall into some sort of collapse or will collapse. In terms of the second one, I loved very much, first of all, because I love all things Greek and I love Orion. But I thought it was the combination of sort of the ancient imagery of sky over the horizon with the idea that I follow in my car on the way to work. Like, we can transcend that moment where we are stuck in traffic and see perhaps a greater reality.
This is something we both picked, stuck in the car thing.
It tells you a little bit about our lives.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for taking the plunge. And I want to again encourage that if these two busy people can do it, then you can do it. And also people who are already good at something else are willing to risk it, then you can do it too. Do you have any advice for our other armchair or behind the wheel poets if they want to take a stab at this?
Well, I said on Facebook this morning, I know you have it in you. I mean, I've been reading their comments on my page for how many years now? I know how creative they are. Some of them don't have Twitter accounts. I said, now's the time. Get on Twitter. I just think that there's something freeing about trying something that you're afraid will embarrass you, and you survive it, and you actually feel pretty good about it.
Fernando?
Yeah, I mean, what I've found in my own experience of being completely panicked and then having to do it because I said I'd do it, is that this format, especially the 140 characters, forces you to get to a deeper truth. And whether you do it for yourself or you do it for someone else, it's a really interesting exercise what pops out of your brain in that context.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. And keep it coming. We know that you'll be watching our Twitter feed and
every day
sending your best selections to us. Fernando Espuelas is host and managing editor of The Fernando Espuelas Show, which is on Univision. Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, Muses and Metaphor continues all month, so send us your original Twitter poems using the hashtag TMMPoetry.
Okay, if you're still catching up on your favorite TV shows, let me say it now. You are being warned. There are major spoilers up ahead.
Oh my God!
And the butchery begins.
We've seen it on Lost, Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, even Family Guy. Major characters getting taken out of the game of life to the horror of viewers and reviewers. It happened again a couple of weeks ago, this time on Scandal. And The Good Wife.
I just saw him a few hours ago.
He was happy.
Author K.M. Weiland says she loves killing people. She runs the blog Helping Writers Become Authors. She recently put together a checklist with do's and don'ts for killing off characters. I asked her about some good reasons to kill off a character.
Definitely that it advances the plot. If the story cannot take place without the death, you know it has to be in there. If it enables the rest of the story, then it's worth whatever heartache you're going to put your readers or your viewers or your other characters through.
What are some of the lame reasons to kill off a character that writers should stay away from?
Basically, the worst reason is shocking readers just for the sake of shocking them. They may be shocked, but they are probably also going to be really mad at you. They need to feel like, even if this death is tragic, that there's a reason behind it. And that's something, as a writer, drives me nuts about television, because a lot of times character deaths, they're motivated by these extraneous real-life reasons, like actors get fired, actors move on. But at the same time, these kind of arbitrary deaths, they have this verisimilitude, this realism that mimics real life, which obviously, you know, people die all the time when it's
right.
Not.
Death isn't thematic.
Yeah, exactly.
Always.
Yeah.
Can you give us an example of a character who needed to go?
Characters such as Uncle Ben in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man.
What happened?
Carjacker, he's been shot.
Spider-Man would not have gone in the direction he had were it not for that motivating death of his uncle. We've got characters at the end of stories like Melanie in Gone with the Wind or Obi-Wan in Star Wars. These characters, they're kind of a capping of the plot and the theme.
Where goodness dies or all hope in humanity is lost or something like that, right?
Exactly, yes. And, you know, they're a final thrust for whatever the main character is experiencing.
Mm-hmm. You've killed off characters in your books, right?
Yes, it's kind of a running joke among my readership that no character is safe. But yes, I often, a lot of times, if there's going to be an important character death in a story, it's a scene that I've known about probably from almost the beginning of my conception of the story. Because these moments, you know, as we can see just from people reacting, you know, to the character deaths in these television shows, we want to explore that. We want to find out, why does this person die and why does he have to die? And where do the surviving characters go on from here?
Yeah, but here's the problem. Viewers and readers do get really attached to these characters, and having them die can be really painful. I mean, the blogosphere goes insane when one of these characters gets killed off on a TV show.
But the very fact that they're reacting so passionately about this means that the story's doing its job. It sucked people in, it involved them with these characters. And as long as the story continues in a way that makes these deaths matter, then most readers and viewers will reconcile to the deaths, even as much as they would have liked the characters to survive.
K.M. Wyland is the author of Outlining Your Novel and the novel Dreamlander. She joined us from her home in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Now we're going to take a trip down memory lane, or we should probably say down the Soul Train line. Now, for a lot of people, just hearing that theme song brings back powerful memories. But for others, know this. For more than three decades, the TV show Soul Train served as a national showcase for Black music and culture. It was the launchpad for stars like Jody Watley and Rosie Perez. And it became the longest-running show on television. Behind it all was the impresario Don Cornelius, who became a legend not only for his on-air cool, but his behind-the-scenes business savvy. When he died, tragic. In February 2012, flash mobs in major cities around the country dressed up in 70s attire to show off their moves in tribute to that legacy. Filmmaker and author Nelson George said modesty and good sense kept him off the Soul Train line that day, but he was there, and that got him thinking that the legacy of Soul Train and Don Cornelius could stand to be better known. So he's written his latest book. It's called The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
So how did the Soul Train bug grab you?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my sister was a couple of years younger than me and a very big dancer. And on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. on a local New York station, Soul Train would come on. We'd sit in front of it, first on in front of one of those black and white TVs, and then a little mini color Trinitron, because those things were tiny at the time. And we would watch the show and watch the moves, and we would know that that afternoon and that night in the schoolyards and house parties, people would try and do Soul Train moves. They would attempt to get their hair the right way. The Soul Train dancers had their afros and those crazy colors. I mean, one thing that you really saw when you saw Soul Train was vibrant. The set was vibrant. The colors of the dancers was quite dynamic. It was California style brought into homes in New York, Detroit, Atlanta, and affected everything. So Soul Train not only entertained us, but it was a guide for style, a guide for dancing, and a guide to music. So it was a very 360 cultural experience.
It was appointment viewing. I bet you if we called right now, five of your friends and five of my friends, we would all have a story about watching Soul Train. Like, you either had to get your chores done so you could watch it, or, you know, something of that sort.
I mean, it was a real glue. I mean, I think the thing about, one of the many things about Soul Train is that it solidified national black culture. When I say that, I mean to say there'd never been a regularly scheduled vehicle ever for black music, black style, black entertainment in TV. It had never been done. When it comes on 1971, we're in black power era. We're in an era where we have black mayors finally getting to be black mayors in major cities. We still have the black power. The riots of the 60s are still very, very vivid in the minds of everyone. So what Soul Train did was take black joy, the excitement, the vitality, the spirit of soul music, of black music, of funk, of the beginnings of disco, and put it here in a format for everyone could enjoy in their living room. It took the idea of blackness and took it away from the news as strife or as conflict, and made it accessible not just to black people, but also to white corporations, because you began seeing slowly advertising on Soul Train. I mean, the thing about Soul Train was that it wasn't just that the dancers and the music was black, but you began seeing black commercials.
Tell us a little bit about Don Cornelius, because I have got to play a clip of his very unique interviewing style in a minute. But tell us a little bit, how did he get to that? How did he come up with the idea?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's a Chicago boy. He always had a sense of cool. Chicago's one of those cities that always had a very strong sense of self. He became a radio DJ. That voice, of course, the deep voice he had made him a natural. Initially, he did a lot of news reporting in Chicago because there was so much competition for jobs. And he would do these parties, for high school kids, because back in that era, a lot of DJs, radio DJs, would make extra money doing sock hops in those days. And because he was going all over town, taking a train across Chicago, it became the Soul Train. And so when he got the idea of doing a local TV show, it became the Soul Train.
I wanted to play a little bit of, for people, if you remember the show, then you really don't need to, you can conjure up that voice, I think, instantaneously.
Sure.
But for people who don't remember it, we have to talk about the Don Cornelius cool. Here it is.
We're back with the Godfather, James Brown. And James, it's been a most exciting experience so far, and I know it's going to get heavier and heavier for the rest of the hour. And I just have to say that just watching you, you're still the baddest out here.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm just trying to keep up with the Soul Train dancers.
Yeah,
nobody
said
nothing.
How about it for the Soul Train dance? James, if you had some advice for young people, what would you tell them?
Well, first thing I'd say, get yourself together. Because before you can get anything else together, you got to get yourself. Hey, that's very short, but it's very direct.
He just sounds like an airline pilot, you know? I mean, he's got this, he never breaks a sweat. I mean, it's just, that was, of course, Don Cornelius and the late Godfather of Soul, James Brown.
And that's him being very effusive.
Exactly. That's what he's
saying. Because he's James
exciting.
Brown.
It's very exciting here. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with author and filmmaker Nelson George. We're talking about his latest book, The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style. Talking a little bit about the dancers, one of the things that's starting to emerge is that you talked about cool and control seem to go together, right? And
right.
We recently interviewed the dancer, choreographer, actress Rosie Perez, who talked about the kind of a, what's the word I'm looking for? Difficult, maybe a little bit volatile relationship that she had with Don Cornelius as a dancer mm-hmm. on the show. And I want to play a short clip from the conversation I had with her. It was after she just published her new memoir, A Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, and she talks about a confrontation she had with him about her dancing. Here it is.
Don Cornelius was very angry, and he kept wanting me to go down the Soul Train line, just, pumping my body, and I didn't want to. And it just got heated. Don got physical, and I got physical back, and he's a very tall, strong man, and the only way I could defend myself was to grab something and throw it at him. And the only thing I could grab was the two-piece Kentucky Fried Chicken dinner that they provided us as payment, and a greasy chicken wing hit him in the forehead, and I was mortified.
Well, I have to ask you about that. I mean, did other dancers have these kinds of set-tos with him?
No, they didn't. I mean, no. Rosie's special case, and also there's a context for that story, is that Rosie had been asked to be part of a sort of a new vocal group that he was putting together along with two other dancers, and she basically had refused. So there was a tension that led to that. It wasn't simply he could make people dance again. He definitely allowed certain dancing and not other dances. I mean, even though it was sexy, it was never nasty. And he was known for having singers, if they didn't lip sync properly, redo songs over again, right? But in terms of that confrontation with Rosie, Rosie was one of his favorites for years, until she had declined to be in this group with him. Then their relationship soured and went really south, the chicken wing incident.
We can't leave this story without talking about his success as a business person, all right? And he owned the show.
Yes.
I don't know whether he was the first, but he was certainly one of the most successful of his time. I mean, people still remember that Desi Arnaz was one of his great innovations. People think of him as I Love Lucy, but his significant contribution was as an owner of that show.
And I mean, so the same way that Mike Douglas owned his show. Uh-huh. Syndicated TV was, you know, it's sort of, people don't even really think about syndicated TV now because of cable's dominance. But that was the other way in. And if you were able to find a sponsor who would get you enough money to produce the content, there were enough independent TV stations around the country that were looking for shows that you could make that sale. And Don was able to do that. It took him, I mean, the thing is, we point out in the book, it wasn't like immediately Soul Train went national. The initial 71, it wasn't everywhere in 1971. It took several years before it had truly national coverage. And even then, in certain markets like Philadelphia, where Questlove talks about the fact it comes on almost at midnight, for, you know, in its initial introduction to Philadelphia. So it was a slow rollout those first 3 years.
It's unfortunate, though. I mean, and again, it's hard to, after looking at all he accomplished, his end was a sad one, which you don't shy away from in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, he shot himself, you know, and...
Well, not just that. I mean, that is sad in and of itself.
Yes, absolutely.
But he also had a very difficult end at the beginning. At the end, it seemed very lonely. I mean, he had married, you know, a younger woman, and you say in the book, well, that's Hollywood, nobody cares. But he'd married a much younger white woman. Their relationship seemed very fractious. They had a contentious divorce.
Right.
And he took his own life. And look, nobody knows why anybody really does anything, do they? But at the end of the day, do you just want to talk about, it seems particularly tragic that for somebody to have been so important and to have had such an important effect on and to mean so much to so many people, that his end seemed very alone.
You know, it's interesting because Clarence Avant, who was one of his chief business advisors and partners from the beginning all the way through the sale of the company, had met with him maybe a week or so before Don's passing, and he felt like, you know, Don was Don. And I do have a sense of isolation. Rosie talks about running into him and feeling like there's something wrong, and they're having a conversation about it. No one I spoke to, at least, could say, oh, I saw it coming or I saw this coming. It was really surprising that he decided to end his life.
How do you want him to be remembered?
Well, I mean, he's obviously the creator of one of the most important television shows in American history. And since TV is one of America's greatest innovations, he's one of the greatest American sort of media presences we've ever had, black or white, because the impact of Soul Train just rolls on.
Nelson George is an author and filmmaker. His latest book, The Hippest Trip in America, Soul Train and the Evolution of Culture and Style, is available now. He was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Nelson George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I think I'll let Don Cornelius sign off for us.
You come on and boogie with us next week on these same stations, and you can bet your last money it's all going to be a stone gas, honey. I'm Don Cornelius, and as always, in parting, we wish you love of peace. And
we just mentioned that dancing on Soul Train was the big break for a number of entertainers like Rosie Perez and Jody Watley. Well, our colleagues at All Things Considered have been hearing stories from a number of other people about the moment when their careers took off. The series is called My Big Break, and as part of the series, they recently spoke with June Ambrose, a celebrity stylist who helps everybody from Jay-Z to Mary J. Blige look sharp on set and on the red carpet. She told us that she got her start in the industry working on music videos, and her big break came from Missy Elliott's The Rain.
Well, when I first sat down with the record label for Missy Elliott, it was to discuss the Super Duper Fly album project. The head of the record label called me in for a meeting along with Missy and her management team. The question was posed to me, how are you, June Ambrose, going to sell this young lady to mainstream America? She was a full-figured girl, and at the time it was all about racy, provocative females in music. The lyrical content was very racy, and it was almost an animated racy. I said, Missy Elliott will be my modern-day cartoon character. Music video director Hype Williams
came to me with this amazing video treatment that talked about Missy Elliott being blown up in this, what he described as like a Michelin man.
Me, I'm super fly, super duper fly, super duper fly.
I said, oh, like a big white blow-up bubble? Like the tire commercials? And I just saw it so differently. I said, well, I would love to use black patent leather. And I designed this big blow-up suit out of a tire inner tube and patent leather on the outside, like more of a vinyl. The contraption was very small, deflated, but once you blew it up, it was the size of maybe a 900-pound man. And we had to take the suit to a gas station to have it blown up. So we walked to the gas station, we blew her up, and then we walked her back to the location where we were shooting. And the suit slowly deflated. It had a small leak. Now, with the way this costume was built, any bit of air that seeped out would not keep the suit inflated. So now I'm like, oh God, what am I going to do? Everyone was screaming, get art department, let's figure this out. I was like, I need a bicycle pump.
This is a Missy Elliott exclusive.
And the director would yell, action. Little me, I'm behind this big inflated suit. And I'm just pumping as she's dancing. I stood behind the suit during every take, keeping the air pressure in the suit, but just allowing enough of it to seep out so that it would pop lock in a way that was just so dynamic. The slight leak actually made the suit a lot more dynamic than I could have ever imagined. And that crazy luck, I gotta tell you, probably changed my life. I earned my wings. If she was skeptical before this experience, she now knew that she could trust me. And I did every music video in her career after that. I think Missy Elliott was really when my big break happened. These outrageous music video moments, because they were so highly recognized and celebrated, they caught on. We never came from behind the curtains. We were the wizards. But people always want to seek out who's creating magic.
That was celebrity stylist June Ambrose telling us about her big break. Our friends at All Things Considered want to hear about your big break. Send an email with your story to mybigbreak, all one word, at npr.org. And if you're looking for your moment to shine in the world of poetry, here's your chance. It's Muses and Metaphor, our month-long Twitter poetry series. According to the Twitter analytics site Topsy, we've already had close to 2,000 poems come in. We're still going strong. Here's a poetic tweet that caught our eye. The Twitter handle is at JLC Writes. A path to independence, wheels to roll away from home. Seeing her in the distance, already on my phone. Now it's your turn. Tweet us your poem using hashtag TMM Poetry. And that's our program for today. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.